We just got done talking about one of DNA's two major functions. DNA replication is one of those functions. The other one, remember, is transcription. But transcription is really just part of the overall process that we're looking at in this final chapter. The final chapter, which is called in this book, From Gene to Protein, is about the overall process called gene expression. Gene expression refers to creating a protein starting with the information that's in DNA. But gene expression as an overall process occurs in two parts, two major parts, in a specific order. The first part is transcription, and that's the only part of gene expression that the DNA, which is what genes are, is involved in. After transcription, though, you have translation, and translation is when the polypeptide, the protein, is actually created using the information that was originally in DNA. All right, now, we'll talk about each of those pieces in detail, but we'll start with slide one, which is the results of another historically important experiment. This is back in the days when we knew that DNA was the genetic material. We're trying to figure out how it works. We knew the structure. Now it's what the big question is, how does it work? And so what investigators in this experiment did was work with mold cells, a fungus, and notice on the bottom they're looking at the effect on biochemical pathways. So in this pathway, a precursor molecule in the first reaction of the pathway gets turned into ornithine, which then gets turned into citrulline, which then gets turned into arginine. And the cells need arginine. They can't live without it. So they have to run this pathway in order to survive. That's normal yeast are able to do that. Normal mold is able to do that. But what they did experimentally was to intentionally cause mutations, changes to the DNA, which is what mutations are. And they did that by irradiating the cells, subjecting them to UV, ultraviolet radiation, the same stuff that can mutate our own cells and give us skin cancer. Now, they had no idea what kind of mutations they were causing. That wasn't the point. They just knew that if they gave them enough UV, they would change the DNA. And then they looked at the effect on the ability to undergo this biochemical pathway. And this in the middle part here, you have the normal ones, which did not mutate. They are able, if given minimal medium is the stuff they're living on, minimal medium is just a medium that has only the bare minimums to survive, including the precursor molecule in this pathway. Well, the normal cells are able to turn that precursor stepwise into arginine, and therefore they're able to survive. But then you have three columns of mutants, and the mutants were not able to survive if all you gave them was the precursor. But they could cause them to survive if they gave them one of the intermediates in the pathway. So notice these ones survived if you just gave them ornithine, which is basically saying, okay, just skip this first step, I'll get you past that, and then from ornithine on, you're on your own, and they survived. This one they had to give citrulline, and this one they had to give arginine. So it looks like the mutations were causing an inability of one of these enzymes or another in the pathway to function. Does that make sense? And therefore they devised what was called the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis. In other words, they were saying, well, what genes are instructions for how to build protein, for how to build enzymes. One gene, one enzyme. Each gene corresponds to an enzyme. And that's not true, as it turns out, for a variety of reasons. One reason, right away, is that even though enzymes have to be coded for by a gene, they can't be built unless the cell is told how to do that. So each gene corresponds to each enzyme corresponds to a gene, but not every gene codes for an enzyme. So it's not true that it's one gene, one enzyme. And that's because enzymes are proteins, but there's all kinds of other proteins as well, right, as we've discussed. All proteins require a gene, so it's not one gene, one enzyme. Well, they revised the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis, the name of it, to one gene, one protein, which is closer to the truth, but it's still flawed. And that's because if you think back to the levels of protein structure that we talked about, primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, remember that quaternary structure applies only to multimeric proteins, which are ones that contain two or more polypeptides. Well, if you have a quaternary protein that has multiple polypeptides different from each other, like hemoglobin, for instance, has four overall, but it has two types, two version A, two version B, all clumped together. Well, that one protein is going to require two genes to code for it, a gene to code for each of the two kinds of polypeptides that it involves. So it's not one gene, one protein, necessarily. And they revised it again into the so-called one gene, one polypeptide hypothesis, which is even closer to the truth, but still flawed. And there's a couple reasons why that's not true. One is that, as we'll see eventually, eukaryotic genes are actually able to code for more than one protein through a mechanism called alternative RNA splicing, which, like I said, we'll learn about that later. So that alone is one reason why one gene, one polypeptide is wrong. But another reason is that not all genes even code for any polypeptide. Now, every gene, if it's transcribed, or when it's transcribed, because genes are transcribed, but every gene, when it is transcribed, gets used in that transcription process to produce a specific thing, which is an RNA molecule. DNA does not directly code for protein. DNA codes for RNA. Transcription has as its product, the thing that's created in transcription, RNA. Well, there are different kinds of RNA, as we'll see. The specific kind of RNA that's usually produced in transcription, and by usually I mean for most genes, is called messenger RNA, mRNA. mRNA is holding the instructions for how to build a protein, but it got that information from the gene. And then mRNA goes on to the second part of gene expression, which I said earlier is translation. That's when the code that's in mRNA gets used to assemble a polypeptide, one amino acid at a time. Well, those genes, the ones that code for specifically messenger RNA, are the so-called protein-coding genes. Because after the both processes, transcription and translation, the final product is a protein. But not all genes do that. So there are some genes that code for other kinds of RNA, because a cell requires all kinds of different kinds of RNA, and they don't know how to make any RNA unless they're told how to do that. So all RNAs require a gene to tell the cell how they're made. Some genes simply tell the cell, make a different kind of RNA, like rRNA, for instance, instead of mRNA. And those are not protein-coding genes, because those kinds of RNAs, the RNA is the final product. It doesn't go on to code for a protein. You see the difference there? Now, that's the minority of genes. Most genes are protein-coding genes. But that's another reason why even the more restrictive hypothesis name, one gene, one polypeptide, is wrong, because not all genes have anything to do with polypeptides. Well, they eventually stopped renaming it, but that was the history. And for the rest of the chapter, unless I specifically say otherwise, when I say gene, I'm going to mean protein-coding gene. The non-protein-coding genes, if I want to talk about them, I'll be careful to say non-protein-coding genes. Okay, so gene expression here refers to expression of protein-coding genes. And we're on slide two, looking at an overview comparing the overall process of gene expression in the two cells making up the dichotomy of cell types. Prokaryotic cell on the top has a little bit easier job of this overall process because of its structural simplicity compared to eukaryotic cells. It is not compartmentalized like a eukaryotic cell is. So the prokaryotic cell has just one compartment. All of that stuff is collectively called the cytoplasm. And therefore, both parts of gene expression, transcription first and then translation, occur in the same compartment in a prokaryote. Transcription is the only part of gene expression that directly involves DNA. So no matter what kind of cell you're talking about, transcription has to occur where the DNA is. But in a prokaryotic cell, the DNA is just in that cytoplasm, so that's where it occurs. The product of transcription for a protein coding gene is always messenger RNA. That's the red thing here. And mRNA is simply storing the information that was in DNA, and DNA's job is done at this point. The messenger RNA then goes on to the second process, translation, which is the process of actually assembling the polypeptide one amino acid at a time. And how the cell knows how to do that is by reading the messenger RNA. The messenger RNA tells the ribosome, which we talked about a little bit already, and we'll talk more about. The ribosome is a little molecular machine that's able to read the sequence of nucleotides in the mRNA. And that tells the ribosome how many amino acids to use and which of the 20 to use in each position for however many there are. In other words, it tells it how to assemble the polypeptide one amino acid at a time. And that's the purple beads here. That's the polypeptide. Once that's done, then gene expression is complete and you have a brand new polypeptide. The process is pretty much the same in a eukaryotic cell, except because it's compartmentalized, there are some differences. Once again, the transcription part has to happen where there's DNA, but in a eukaryotic cell, that's in its own compartment, in the nucleus. So that's where transcription occurs in a eukaryotic cell. It makes mRNA, the product of transcription, just like it does for a prokaryote. But here's a difference. Prokaryotic mRNA is, as it's coming off of the transcription assembly line, it's already in its final form ready to go for translation. Not true for a eukaryotic cell. That's why we call the stuff that transcription produces directly pre-mRNA, because it has to be modified in a eukaryote before it can do its job in translation. All right. Now, since those modifications, and we'll talk about those later, occur after transcription, we call those modifications post-transcriptional modifications. And that occurs for eukaryotic mRNA. And among other things, what you see in the picture here is that these yellow ends get added. Another thing that's different is that mRNA, as it's produced in transcription in a eukaryote, is not in the right compartment for it to do its job. Its job is to undergo translation, but that's where the ribosomes are, which is out in the cytoplasm. The mRNA is produced in the nucleus. So it has to be able to get out of the nucleus in order to meet up with ribosomes to do its job. And that's why it's important for the nuclear envelope to feature these nuclear pores we talked about earlier. They're holes made of protein complexes all over the surface so that these messenger RNAs can get out after they're produced. All right, slide three. The piece of DNA we're looking at the top is just a tiny fragment of the overall length. An entire DNA, the entire length of a chromosome, that's one DNA, one double-stranded DNA, typically contains thousands of genes, not just three. So we're looking at just a few genes. And you get an idea of what I was saying before. Genes are just subsets of the sequence. There's one overall long sequence. Subsets of the sequence are called genes, and then there are non-coding sequences between those. It's all DNA nucleotides. It's all C's, T's, A's, and G's. But a gene is simply a particular set of nucleotides that tell the cell how to make one RNA molecule. Okay. Now, one thing that the book is kind of lying to you here is that it doesn't show these non-coding sequences nearly as long as they are. Because when you think about the overall length of DNA in your body, for instance, but it's typical in other species as well, only about 1% of your DNA is in genes. The vast majority of your DNA is these long stretches between genes. So it's much longer than it looks here. Anyway, what we're concerned with here is a gene, and below the box on the top, we're looking at just a little piece of gene 1. This isn't the entire gene. That's why it fades out in blue. But a gene is DNA, so it's double-stranded. There are two strands here, and notice the anti-complementary arrangement. 3 prime to 5 prime at the top, 5 prime to 3 prime on the bottom strand. Now, in the previous chapter, when we talked about DNA replication, both strands were used in the process, right? You separate the two strands, and each individual strand serves as a template for how to make a copy of the other one. So you have to do this to both strands in DNA replication. Here we're looking at transcription, and there are two strands in the DNA, of course, but only one of them gets used as a code, not both of them. And which of the two strands gets used just depends on the gene. In this particular example, the top one is the one that gets used, and whichever one gets used is called the template strand, right? Now, the very next gene, after you have this intervening sequence between them, it might be the bottom strand or it might be the top. You just don't know. One of the two strands only, though, is the one that actually gets read by the cell. And the one that gets read is called the template strand. Also, remember what I've been telling you. You can't do either of DNA's two functions, replication or transcription, unless you separate the strands. So we're going to separate the strands in transcription, just like we did in replication, but we're only going to read one of the strands. The other one's just going to be left flopping there for a moment while we read the template strand. Now, transcription here involves making messenger RNA using complementarity rules while reading the template strand of DNA. And if you look at this sequence in the template strand, if you were going to replicate that strand, just the top strand, in DNA replication, then you would have a sequence that looks just like the bottom one, right? Because you would read the A, and that would call for a T. You would read the C, that would call for a G, and so on. But our goal here is not to make DNA. Our goal is to make RNA. So remember the differences between DNA and RNA that we talked about. Both of them use 4 of the 5 normal nitrogenous bases, right? But it's not the same 4. DNA uses adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. RNA uses uracil instead of thymine. Okay? That's why this A that gets read in the DNA, which would normally call for a T, calls for a U in RNA terms instead of a T, because there are no Ts in RNA. But all the others that don't involve reading an A get the same kind of letter as you would in the DNA replication scheme. In other words, the complementarity rules are the same, except it's A with U, or A specifies U, T specifies A, C specifies G, and G specifies C. That's how this sequence of RNA came about. The cell doesn't know this sequence. It has to be told that. And the job of the gene is to tell the cell, this is the sequence of mRNA nucleotides I need. Even though they use different nucleotides, both DNA and RNA have 4 kinds, right? And therefore, there is a one-to-one correspondence in transcription between nucleotides, DNA nucleotides and RNA nucleotides, meaning one DNA nucleotide specifies one RNA nucleotide. Right? A specifies U, C specifies C, and so on. Before I get to my next point, I want to explain why these things are, why these two parts of gene expression are, get their names. Transcription and translation are easily confused by people just learning this because they both start with trans. But I want you to think about what the words mean and why they were chosen to describe these. Transcription is the noun form of the verb transcribe, which means to rewrite. Right? If you order a transcript of a news program, for instance, you'll get a written account of what was said. But transcription does not involve a change in language. It's just rewriting something down. Okay? The language here that we're starting with in DNA, if you want to use language analogy, is the language of nucleotides. That's what, you know, these letters are kind of like words. The language is nucleotides. And so transcription doesn't involve a change in language. It involves simply a rewriting. And the DNA, by the way, itself, the gene, which is the DNA, that is very much like an instruction manual for how to build a protein. But it's an instruction manual that you can get only at the library, and it's a non-circulating book. It's one of these books that you can use at the library, but you can't take home. You can't check it out. It has to stay in the library. So if you want to make a protein, but you don't want to do it in the library because you, all your materials are at home, you go to the library and you copy down the instructions from the book that you're using at the library. Well, that book is the gene. And once you copy those down, which is what transcription is, the book's job is done. You give it back to the librarian and file it back into the library. You then take that copy of the instructions, which is the mRNA transcript, as it's called, the piece of mRNA that gets produced. And that's what you directly follow then to actually assemble the polypeptide away from the library. Okay? Well, that is translation. The assembly of the protein is translation. And that, in everyday language, refers to a change in language, right? It's not simply a rewriting. You are expressing that information in a new language when you translate something. And that makes sense here because mRNA is still in the language of nucleotides, but now we need to go to the language of amino acids. Polypeptides are written in the language of amino acids. That's why you need a translation from nucleotides to amino acids. So make sense of these words. And you can, that way you can always remember which one comes first, because you have to start with DNA, right? DNA to RNA is no change in language, it's simply a transcription. But now back to this fact that transcription involves a one-to-one correspondence between DNA nucleotides and RNA nucleotides. That's nice. And it would be very nice if there was also a one-to-one correspondence between mRNA nucleotides and amino acids in translation. But there cannot be. If it were possible, that's the way it would be because it's the simplest. And so evolution would favor that simplicity. Why is it that there can't be a one-to-one correspondence between mRNA nucleotides and amino acids? In other words, why can it not be that a single mRNA nucleotide specifies a single amino acid? What's the problem? These three-letter abbreviations are amino acids, right? Tryptophan, phenylalanine, glycine, and so on. Why can't we say, okay, just U by itself in messenger RNA, uracil, That's going to specify tryptophan. Exactly right. There are, remember, no limit to the number of amino acids in a laboratory, but in biology, cells use 20. So you can't use four symbols to specify uniquely all 20 amino acids. It was a one-to-one correspondence in DNA because there's four in DNA nucleotides and there's four in RNA. So you can have a one-to-one. One is not enough because you would run out after four. You could only specify four amino acids. That's not nearly enough. Therefore, the next simplest solution would be to use a sequence of two RNA nucleotides to specify each amino acid. Well, if you're working with four kinds of RNA nucleotides and you're using a sequence of two, how many possible sequences are there? You have four choices for the first digit, and for each of those, you have four for the second digit, right? So overall, there's how many?
16.
Exactly, four times four. Well, 16 is still not enough. You need 20. So that didn't evolve either because it can't work. Therefore, the simplest possibility that will work is to use a sequence of three mRNA nucleotides to specify each amino acid. And a sequence of three nucleotides is called a triplet, whether it's in DNA or RNA. All right, now, if you use a triplet, how many possible sequences are there? 64. 4 times 4 times 4. And notice that 64 is plenty. All you needed were 20, but you have 64 to work with. So that's why it didn't go to 4. 4 would be even more complex, needlessly complex, and it would never have been favored by evolution. So the triplets that are in mRNA, the three-digit sequences, they have the special name codon. A codon is a triplet of mRNA nucleotides that together specifies uniquely an amino acid. So UGG says to the cell, tryptophan is what I need. And all the other 20 amino acids have their own codons associated with them. Okay? That's translation. Reading not individual nucleotides, but codons of mRNA, one codon at a time, telling the cell, use this amino acid for the next one until you're done. So the cell says, okay, you've already added the last one. The polypeptide is complete. All right, now let's go to four. This table that we're looking at is the genetic code. And the reason that I'm making such a point of stressing the word the is because this is not just the human genetic code or just sea urchin genetic code or just bacterial genetic code. This is the universal genetic code that all organisms use. And the fact that all organisms use this is one of the very important, most important bits of information that tell us all organisms descended from the same original successful cells. We're all related because the first ones to use this code turned into everything else. Okay, but the genetic code is really just an exhaustive listing of codons. You just told us that there are 64 possible codons. All 64 possible sequences are shown here. All right? And the uppercase triplets here are the codons themselves. Notice these are RNA codons, so there's no T's in them. Only use A's, C's, and G's. Now, each codon written to the right of it has a three-digit, but it's not all caps, abbreviation, which is simply an abbreviation for an amino acid. So phenylalanine, leucine, isoleucine, and so on. All these are abbreviations. Now, you don't have to memorize the abbreviation for the amino acids, but you'll find all 20 amino acids listed here. And each codon corresponds to an amino acid. That's the genetic code. There are 64 overall codons, but notice that only 61 of them actually specify amino acids. These three orange ones do not specify amino acids. They, as you see, are all called stop codons. All right, now stop codons is a pretty descriptive name. What a stop codon does is tell the ribosome, which is in charge of assembling the polypeptide in translation, you've already added the last amino acid in the previous step. Now it's time to stop. The job of translation is done. And it doesn't matter which of these three comes up to do that job. They all equally do the same thing. They tell the ribosome that the process of translation is complete. All right, those are the orange ones. The other 61 specify amino acids, but there's this one green one, which is special for a different reason. It does double duty. AUG is the special codon called the start codon. So just like there are stop codons, there's a start codon that tells the ribosome this is where you start. Because as we'll see later, the RNA actually has more codons or more sequence in it than just the codons. There are some upstream nucleotides, but the start codon is important because when the ribosome recognizes that start codon, it says, okay, this is where I'm going to start reading codons. That's one of AUG's functions, to be a start codon. But it also does double duty because AUG always specifies methionine, which is what the MET stands for. That's an amino acid. So AUG can occur many times or multiple times within the same RNA, but it has to occur at least at the beginning because that's the start codon. And then later on, if there needs to be methionine in different positions, you would have that same codon occurring. Notice what this means, though, is that every polypeptide that gets produced starts with methionine as the first amino acid, whether the cell wants it that way or not, because methionine is the methionine coding codon is the start codon. As it turns out, methionine should not be in every polypeptide, so after the polypeptide gets made, it needs to be modified after translation to remove that. But it's there to begin with. As we're looking at this genetic code, I want to say two really important things about it. One is that the genetic code is not ambiguous, but the genetic code is redundant. And so it's important to understand both of those words. Let's start with redundant. I said that it is redundant, the genetic code, but redundant refers to saying the same thing over and over, right? In language, redundancy is illustrated by synonyms. And compared to any other language, English has more synonyms than any other language because it's really a combination of a bunch of languages. So there's all kinds of ways in English to say big. You don't have to use the word big. Okay, they all specify the same meaning, though. The genetic code is redundant because there are multiple codons, multiple possible codons that you could use to specify the same amino acid. Leucine, for instance, one of the amino acids, can be specified by any one of these six codons. That's like having six different ways of saying big, only you're saying leucine. Now, why is there redundancy in the genetic code? That's right. Simply because you have to use three nucleotides in RNA to specify all 20, but that gives you 64 possibilities, not just 20. So you have a bunch more codons than you actually need, and therefore they're doubled up or sometimes tripled up or more. That's redundancy, and the genetic code is redundant. But I also said it is not ambiguous. So if you think about ambiguity in everyday language, what does it mean to be ambiguous? If someone is being ambiguous, what does that mean? It is a type of vagueness. It's vagueness specifically for the reason that there are multiple possible meanings to the words being used. All right? And an easy example is with the word hot. If I say I'm hot, simple sentence, there's at least four possible ways to interpret that, right? It could be that I have a fever, elevated body temperature. It could mean that I'm really angry at the moment. It could mean that I am a very popular celebrity. Or it could mean that I'm sexually attractive, and maybe even more meanings. But at least those four, right? So just that phrase, I'm hot, does not necessarily convey the meaning I'm intending it to. Depends on how you receive it. Well, that would be disastrous in the genetic code, because what ambiguity would mean is that a single codon would specify a certain amino acid in certain cases and other amino acids in other cases. Therefore, the ribosome, when it reads an ambiguous codon, wouldn't know which amino acid to put down. And it would end up often making the wrong polypeptide, which would not have the right shape to do the job. And the cell would not be able to survive. So the genetic code cannot be cannot be ambiguous, and it isn't. You can see that it isn't in the code because every codon corresponds to exactly one and only one amino acid. That's non-ambiguity. Now in 5, these photographs are not retouched photographs. This tobacco plant on the left and this pig on the right, they are both actually glowing when you shine ultraviolet light on them. They're fluorescing. That's not the normal case, though, for tobacco plants or for pigs. They don't usually glow when you put UV on them. These ones actually are, though. And that's because they've both been genetically modified. They've received a gene from some other organism that naturally does glow. The tobacco plant received a gene from a firefly, which naturally glows. And the pig received a gene from a jellyfish that naturally glows. So the question here is, why does a gene from a firefly, that of course works in a firefly because it's a firefly gene, why does that gene allow some other organism to glow as though it's a firefly as well? Why is it that genes can be transplanted and still code for the same protein? Yes, but why is it that the same polypeptide gets made in an organism that shouldn't have that gene to begin with? Exactly, because of the universality of the genetic code. So it's not our code, it's everyone's code. If you take a gene from some other organism, you're going to transcribe it and translate it the same way. And that's exactly what has happened here. Now we can get into the particulars of the process of transcription first, starting on slide 6. Notice right away that transcription of DNA, which is really redundant. Transcription is always of DNA. But transcription occurs in 3 major parts. Initiation, elongation, termination. Which are really descriptive terms. Initiation, just another word for starting. So initiation requires the cell to recognize the beginning of a gene. Remember, genes are not really structurally different from the surrounding DNA sequences. It's just a particular sequence within a longer sequence. But the cell needs to know where the gene begins so that it can start reading it there. And that place at the beginning of a gene that, this is the DNA, the beginning of the gene that is recognizable by the cell is called the promoter. The promoter is pointing to the DNA in this region, in the seafoam colored region. That's the promoter. All right. Now, the promoter is able to be recognized by a specific enzyme involved in transcription called RNA polymerase. This is named polymerase for the same reason that DNA polymerase was named in the previous chapter, except we're not polymerizing a DNA, we're instead going to polymerize an RNA. We're going to hook together a bunch of RNA nucleotides to make a polynucleotide called mRNA. Before any RNA gets laid down, though, the RNA polymerase, which is the egg-shaped thing in the cartoon, needs to bind to the promoter. It recognizes and binds to the promoter, to the DNA, at the beginning of the gene. Okay, and then elongation involves separating the two strands, but remember, only one of these two strands is going to be used. The other one's just going to be taken out of the way temporarily. In this case, it's the bottom strand that is the template strand. And RNA polymerase reads the DNA nucleotides one nucleotide at a time, and using complementarity rules, lays down one corresponding or complementary RNA nucleotide at a time. Compare this to DNA replication. The first things to be laid down in DNA replication were RNA primers, which are problematic because we were trying to build DNA. Well, here we're trying to build RNA. So we don't call these primers. This RNA that gets laid down is right away part of the final product. You don't have to replace it. Okay? So it's just a matter of unzipping the two strands more and more, reading more and more of the template strand, and adding nucleotides one at a time to the RNA strand. That's why it's called elongation. It's getting longer and longer. So the RNA is coming off of this assembly line, and eventually the end of the gene gets reached, which is why we call that final step termination. Just another name for ending. Termination involves a disintegration of this transcription complex, meaning that the RNA polymerase detaches from the gene. The two strands of the gene go back together nicely and easily because they're still complementary to each other and they hydrogen bond. And the RNA is now complete and it's on its own. Okay, it's almost as simple as that, but in slide 7 we see what's happening in a eukaryotic cell. A eukaryotic cell's gene has a promoter, and it is true that RNA polymerase needs to bind to that promoter for initiation to occur, and until initiation occurs, the gene is just off. The gene's there, but it's not being transcribed, which is usually the case, by the way. Don't lose track of the fact that every one of your trillions of cells has the same genetic library. Every cell has all the genes in it. But in any given cell, most of those genes never get turned on. Otherwise, you would be able to make teeth in your liver. Right? You only want to make teeth in the right place in your body. So most of the genes in any given cell are turned off. And even if they are going to use the gene, they're not using them all the time. So genes get turned on or off. Well, turning it on means initiation of transcription occurs. And in a eukaryotic cell, it's not as direct as I just showed you in the previous slide. Yes, the RNA polymerase does bind to the promoter, but only if only if certain other proteins, because the RNA polymerase is itself a protein, certain other proteins bind to that promoter first. And there can be several of these proteins that have to be there in place first. We call these proteins transcription factors. It's another use of the word factor to refer to a protein of some sort. Okay? Transcription factors control whether a gene gets turned on or not. Because even though the RNA polymerase is there and the promoter is there, it can't bind to that promoter unless the transcription factors are there first. So the cell can keep the gene turned off until all those transcription factors are produced. Now, appreciate the complexity that's involved here, because these transcription factors are proteins. Where do they come from? They come from transcribing genes and creating messenger RNA for those genes and then translating the messenger RNA into those proteins. So we have some genes whose job it is to indirectly code for transcription factors, whose job is then to control whether other genes are turned on. But sometimes you have not necessarily three, but many transcription factors, some of which could be present most of the time, but you need all of them there. And only until they're all there will the RNA polymerase bind and turn that gene on. All right, now to eight. A little earlier today I said that eukaryotic cells produce mRNA that's not yet ready to go right off of the assembly line, which is why we call it pre-mRNA. So pre-mRNA needs to be modified in eukaryotes before it can go on to the translation process. And there's two major kinds of modifications that take place that we're going to talk about. One is what we're seeing here, and that is to add these yellow ends. At one end, we have the so-called 5' cap. That's, of course, at the 5' end. The other end gets a poly-A tail, because it's a bunch of adenine nucleotides hooked together. Now, these are important because without them, the mRNA would not be able to dock to the protein complexes forming the nuclear pores. This mRNA needs to get out of the nucleus, and so it needs those ends in order to do that, to get strung out of the pores. All right? Just to make sense of these other things, notice the start codon is right here, but you have some part of the pre-mRNA in red here called the UTR. UTR stands for untranslated region. This is what I meant earlier when the ribosome needs to scan this until it gets to the first incidence of a start codon, and that's where it starts reading codons one at a time. This part is not translated. And then you have a stop codon, any one of the three eventually. That's the end of the codons. And then you have another untranslated region. All right, that's one kind of post-transcriptional modification of mRNA that occurs in eukaryotes. Now let's talk about the other kind, slide 9. We already have the tails put on, but this is still pre-mRNA because we haven't finished the modification. Look at the non-yellow part of this. It includes yellow and pink regions. The reason this is important is because these pink regions, which are labeled as introns, are going to be cut out, and they're not going to be used in the final prod, in the final mRNA. The dark red are exons. Now, the X of part of the exon word stands for expression. So they are going to be expressed, meaning they're going to be used as codons in translation. And they are in the final mature mRNA. The introns, the int part of introns, stands for intervening sequences. So they are nucleotides just like exons are, but they're not going to be left in the mRNA. They're going to be snipped out. And that's why this final version of mRNA, the mature mRNA on the bottom, is shorter. The introns have been removed. This involves recognizing where each intron starts and ends, snipping those beginning and end points, removing the introns, and keeping track of all the exons and sewing them all together end to end, which has to be a careful process. Because you can't just randomize this thing or you'll make a totally wrong protein. Has to be a careful process. Okay, so that's the other part of post-transcriptional modification. Let's look in slide 10 at the molecular machine responsible for this, which is called mRNA splicing. It's just like splicing a movie where you take certain frames out and then hook the other ones around them together. The molecular machine responsible for this is called a spliceosome. It's an enormous protein and RNA complex. This huge thing is the spliceosome. But it contains multiple subcomponents called snRNPs, which stands for small nuclear ribonucleoproteins. Some people call them SNRPs, but it's snRNP. That's not an entire spliceosome, that's just one part. But a ribonucleoprotein is something that is partly RNA and partly protein. Right? Ribonucleo refers to the RNA portion, and protein to the protein, of course. So one RNP is made up of proteins along with a single-stranded RNA, which is typical for RNA to be single-stranded, called snRNA. So this is one example of a different kind of RNA that I was talking about before. mRNA is just one of many kinds of RNA. snRNA and protein together make up an snRNP. Multiple different snRNPs are then complexed with still other proteins to make the gigantic spliceosome. And the spliceosome is the thing that is able to recognize the beginning and the end of an intron, not only recognize those beginnings and ends, but snip them, remove the intron, and sew together the exons, leaving them in the final product. Now, the introns that get removed are useless at this point as far as translation is concerned. They're done. They're not part of the process anymore. But they are not entirely useless. They are still valuable molecularly. They're made up of RNA nucleotides, so it gets digested into individual nucleotides, which can then be recycled to make more RNA. Okay, now in 11, I need to give you a couple definitions. We're looking at a gene here in simple form at the top, and it has some exons and introns. But notice that there are, on the bottom figure, which is the polypeptide that gets produced, things called domains. Domains are not complete molecules. Domains are just parts of a polypeptide. And so they are analogous to functional groups, which we've discussed for other kinds of molecules, right? Functional groups are so called because if a molecule contains a functional group of a certain sort, that will give that molecule certain properties or functions. Similarly, if a polypeptide contains a domain of some sort, it's able to do a certain function. All right? Domains are not the entire polypeptide, though. But notice that domains correspond to exons here. And so this particular polypeptide has these three domains because these three exons were part of the messenger RNA after the introns got removed. Well, earlier today, when I was talking about why the one gene, one polypeptide hypothesis is wrong, I said that it's possible in eukaryotes for a single gene to code for more than one polypeptide. And that's because of something that happens in eukaryotes called alternative mRNA splicing. Splicing always occurs because you need to get rid of the introns. But alternative splicing refers to the fact that a pre-mRNA that's always the same because it always comes from the same gene can be spliced in different ways. So it could be spliced so that exon 2 is more or less considered an intron. And so it would have only exon 1 and exon 3, and it would only have those two corresponding domains. That's a different version of a protein. But it's still called for by the same gene. All right. So this is one reason to explain why we were surprised by the results of the Human Genome Project, which around 2000 we finally got the answer to how many genes humans have, and it was a lot smaller than we thought. It's roughly 20,000. But we actually are able to make many more kinds of polypeptides than 20,000 because some genes can be alternatively spliced and therefore give rise to more than one kind of polypeptide. All right, now this is a perfect place to stop because it's the end of transcription, the beginning of translation. So just remind me that I'm on 12. Well, remind me later.